From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Two Timorese win the Nobel Peace Prize, José Ramos Horta and Bishop Carlos Jiménez Bello. We have interviews with both. And we'll take a look at the School of the Americas, what is known as the School of Assassins by many. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Tom Davis, Mitch Kincannon, Larry Rapogal, and my dear friend.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The AIDS quilt is being unfurled here in the nation's capital, and nearly a million people are expected to visit it this weekend. Since it was last shown in its entirety 4 years ago, the quilt has doubled in size to comprise some 40,000 individual panels made in memory of people who have died of AIDS.
Antonio Medina, Carlos P. Hernandez, Van Ordway, Primrose Roll, Lee.
And this weekend is very big in Washington. The Latino March is going to be taking place tomorrow. Thousands of Latinos from around the country are expected to attend. You're listening to Democracy Now! A Roman Catholic bishop and an exiled activist have won the Nobel Peace Prize today for their work in East Timor. José Ramos Horta and Bishop Carlos Felipe Jiménez Bello will share the $1.1 million. The men are being cited for their work toward a just and peaceful solution to the conflict in East Timor. That conflict is Indonesia invaded 21 years ago, and since that time, they have killed more than 200,000 people. Yes, these are the sounds of East Timor. Those the sounds of Indonesian military officers. Indonesian military officers holding US M16s opening fire on a crowd of peaceful demonstrators November 12, 1991. As a result of that massacre, 270 Timorese were killed. I was there along with journalist Alan Nairn. We were beaten, put before a firing squad, but we did survive. The Timorese did not. Right now, we're going to play you two interviews. One we did in East Timor just 2 years ago when we made it back into East Timor despite the fact that the Indonesian military had banned us from returning to the country because we had survived the massacre of 1991. When we got there, we had attempted three times to get into East Timor in 1994. The first time we were arrested, the second time we were sent back, the third time we got in. During that time, we were able to interview Bishop Carlos Felipe Jiménez Bello, the man who has just won the Nobel Peace Prize. This is a bit of what he had to say.
You said the situation hasn't changed. Can you describe what the situation is today?
I say that the same because we still have this number of the military, the security forces. We have still the pressure on the population without freedom to speak, yet to have different opinion. And then the security forces are everywhere. So about the 12 November 91, yeah, we don't have the bodies of the people shot in the cemetery. Their family still waiting, and also the trial for the military was so soft comparing with the Timorese who receive bad condemnation for their attitude.
How does the military repression today compare to the way it was in 1991?
Well, now that the military authorities, they realize that there is a world attention, so they use now the use of the instrument of protection. But another day I hear that the stone, no? There were militaries. They dressed in civil dress, and they had in their hands the stones and wood provoke the young people. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what effect has the world attention had on the military's conduct here?
It is necessary to insist on that they must reduce the number of the military. It is possible to withdraw the battalions and let the East Timor military, Timorese police, to manage with the situation here, because they know better the situation around the Indonesian troops.
These recent confrontations, how does this relate to the Indonesian military occupation of East Timor? How has that affected these events?
The same, the same situation of power and pressure and the military occupation without possibility of dialogue, of conversation, mainly regarding the political aspiration of the people here. So I think that we will continue with this kind of situation in East Timor.
What is the solution for East Timor? The
solution is that the government should be sit down and to talk with the East Timor people.
Do you still favor a referendum, a UN-supervised referendum?
For me now, I see that the different kind signals of manifesting demonstration, the best way is still referendum. So I think that this is necessary to help.
Given all the political changes that have happened since in the world, since the November 12, 91 massacre, do you now see that a UN-sponsored referendum is any closer for East Timor? Is it any more possible now than it was then?
I don't know. I have no more hope, because, but it is necessary to insist. Maybe now with this event, with the journalists, the world now is more aware about the situation here.
What kind of pressure do you personally feel as the bishop here in Timor?
Mainly from the central government, I hear that, and I have also veridical information that they like me to be removed. Yes.
Do they have that kind of power?
Oh, at least I was told that they like to write a letter to the Vatican, to the Holy See, to remove me from here.
Have they written it yet?
I don't know. There is at least there's. They told that this measure was taken by the ambassador Lopez da Cruz and his friends to write a letter to the government insisting on that the bishop should be removed.
And what is your, how does that affect you?
I am ready to be removed. There's any problem for me. Yes.
Were you born here?
Yes, I am from Baucau. Yes.
Have you received any other kinds of pressure?
Mainly this one. Another one that the bishop is his enemy of Indonesia, is anti-integration, and many criticism from the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Alatas, and that I'm not doing my pastoral duty job, but I'm a political one. So you see this kind of pressure. And also the difficulty for the missionary to get visa to stay.
In 1990, you described some of the threats you received, physical threats, anonymous threats.
It doesn't happen now, but it happened in another way, delicate way, maybe to be removed. Mm-hmm. Yes.
When Alatas says that you're being political, what is your response to that?
My response that Alatas doesn't know situation here. He is far from East Timor. He is Indonesian one. He is Muslim. He is not Timor. He is not Catholic. He doesn't know the real psychology and the situation, the mentality of East Timor people. Yes.
What do you think the United States government position should be now regarding Indonesia? Should the United States government, for example, continue to sell weapons to Indonesia?
Well, the business is between Indonesia and I don't have any comment yet to say, but important to also to pay attention for the East Timor people. And President Clinton should be more stronger in his statements. If in 1975 President Ford gave order to Indonesian troops to enter East Timor, I think that now it is the right time for President Clinton to say the Indonesian withdraw for East Timor. Yes.
What kind of effect do you think that would have if President Clinton said that?
But it's necessary for the president to say it, but it is so soft. I think that President Clinton should be stronger in its position and pressure under Indonesia.
What was your reaction to Clinton's statement during APEC when he said that he had received assurances from Indonesia about the safety of the young people who had been captured trying to enter the embassy, and he was satisfied, he was happy with those assurances?
I don't agree that the Timorese, the 29 Timorese, will be saved. I don't have hope.
Why not?
Because here in Indonesia, the situation is totally different, not in the democratic countries. So here the promise is very good, but then real concrete life is the problem. We have many, many problems.
Bishop Carlos Jimenez Bello, the Bishop of East Timor. He and José Ramos Horta have just won the Nobel Peace Prize. We were speaking with Bello in East Timor in 1994. I was there with journalist Alan Nairn. Just a few months ago, when José Ramos Horta was in this country, the second Nobel Peace Prize winner today, I also got a chance to talk to him about the situation in East Timor and the U.S. relationship and support for the Indonesian dictatorship and its military occupation of East Timor. José Ramos Horta is the spokesperson for the East Timorese resistance. I asked him to describe the situation in the occupied island.
The human rights situation in East Timor has deteriorated seriously in the last 12 months. There has been hundreds of arrests of young people. That has been a deliberate strategy on the part of Indonesia to crack down on those who they perceive to be the backbone of the resistance. Hundreds of young kids have been arrested in the last 12 months. They are subject to torture, and after a week, 2 weeks, they are released. And when they are released, they are totally incapacitated, both physically and mentally. On the other hand, there is a massive military presence in the territory. Hundreds of troops, thousands of troops have been engaged in a massive campaign against the resistance. And in consequence, the civilian population suffer retaliation. There are about 20 to 30,000 Indonesian troops on the ground.
Democracy Now! Is a daily election show, and this is an election year, of course, in the United States. One of the slogans of both the Democrats and the Republicans of many Americans is that the United States represents democracy in the world. Can you talk about the United States' relationship to the occupation, the relationship to Indonesia and East Timor?
Well, the United States might represent democracy to the United States itself. What I know of the United States is the American weapons that are used in East Timor against our people, my own relatives. Three brothers, one sister, were killed by American weapons. Many other Timorese were wiped out by American weapons.
In the case of your family, what happened? What were the weapons that they were hurt, that they were killed by?
One of my sisters, her name is Maria Zinha. She was 21 years old at the time in 1977 when two Bronco aircraft attacked a village. There were several hundred kids there, women, children. And my sister was a school teacher at the time in an area that was controlled by the resistance. In 1977, the resistance was very much in control of most of the territory. Two-thirds of the country at least were in the resistance hands. So my sister was a school teacher there. And two Bronco aircraft attack. They drop bombs, they fire with machine gun, and my sister and 20 other kids were killed. This Bronco aircraft was supplied during the Jimmy Carter administration, and within a few days of their delivery to East Timor, to Indonesia, and then arrival in East Timor, my sister was killed. Another brother of mine, his name is Guilherme, was killed during a helicopter assault by Bell helicopters, with many other people as well killed. And another brother, Nuno, he was killed by M16. He was captured in a shop, killed by the Indonesians using M16s. So if the United States talk about it is the example of democracy, well, maybe for Americans, for the rest of the world, in particular East Timor, I don't think it can talk about democracy. And none of the two candidates have offered so far that we know, from a Timorese perspective, any real alternative in terms of a American foreign policy that is more humane, more generous, that is more consistent with what the Americans claim to be their values.
And yet, just a few months ago, when Suharto came to the United States, the military dictator of Indonesia, he met with President Clinton, and the New York Times did a piece quoting a high-level, a senior official in the Clinton administration, saying, Suharto, he's our kind of guy.
Well, sure, Suharto is a U.S. kind of guy, as Saddam Hussein at one point was, as Pinochet was, Somoza, Ferdinand Marcos, well, you name it, every dictator in the world has been the American kind of guy. So I'm not surprised at all that now they say Suharto is that kind of guy as well.
Has there been any grassroots action in this country that has made a difference around any of the stances of the U.S. government toward Indonesia?
To some extent, I must say, to a very limited extent, it has an impact because this grassroots work, again, is still extremely limited when you compare with massive movements against apartheid in the 60s, 70s, 80s. If you compare with the movement in solidarity with the struggles in El Salvador, Nicaragua, or Vietnam in the 60s. So obviously the impact is very limited. Nevertheless, a combination of factors, the work of the grassroots of the U.S. Catholic churches, maybe other churches as well, and some long-standing support by some congressmen like Tony Hall, who have championed the case of East Timor almost for 20 years now, we achieved some minor results, namely the banning of the IMET, the International Military Education Training Program, the few years ago, the banning of the F-5E aircraft to be sold to Indonesia from the Jordanian Royal Air Force, the banning of small arms. So there has been some small, mild gestures on the part of the United States, and that is a result of a combination of factors, not only the grassroots work as such, but because also of the international media coverage of the issue, which in turn helped the work of the grassroots. If the work of the grassroots were to expand, to consolidate, to be more active, I believe it could make even further impact.
You talked about the pressure of the international community and the international press. What about the U.S. press?
I must say the U.S. press has, by and large, ignored the issue. There has been some improvement in the last few years. The New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek have a few articles on East Timor. CNN probably has had the best coverage, but of course, you know, the means of communication, the media that is much more consistent, has given the best coverage of East Timor for many years now, is WBAI, and we have to thank you for that. I don't think anywhere else in the world, even if you compare with Australia or England, where there is issue is much more well known, there is any considerable or comparative coverage when you compare to your program.
We're talking to José Ramos Horta, who is a special representative of the Timorese resistance. He has been speaking out on behalf of his country since the Indonesians invaded in December of 1975. He was at the United Nations for more than 10 years representing the people of East Timor and now travels the world, continues to be a person without a home, though not a person without a country. His country is East Timor. He just can't return there right now.
Let me ask you this. Right now, the U.S. administration, the Clinton administration, is considering selling F-16. The Clinton administration is considering approving F-16 fighter planes, a group of them, to go to Indonesia. What would this mean for East Timor?
The F-16s might not have a direct impact on East Timor itself, because the nature of the terrain, the nature of the warfare there, we conduct a low-level intensity warfare, guerrilla warfare against the occupation. So it's very difficult for the Indonesians to use it directly against the guerrillas. But potentially they can use it anytime in the future against civilian population, because there is no guerrilla movement that can survive without to cover from the civilian population. And if a government or an army wants to wipe out to any support to the resistance, it has to attack civilian population to demoralize them, to inflict enough cost on the population itself that they will have to betray the resistance or be decimated. So the F-16s, though might not have a tactical value in East Timor, it has have a strategic impact in the long run. And so we view with utmost concern the decision of the United States to sell F-16s to Indonesia. Particularly, the regime is one of the worst in the region, one of the worst in the world, selling F-16 to Indonesia like selling to China, like selling to Saddam Hussein of Iraq.
José Ramos Horta, spokesperson for the Timorese resistance. He and Bishop Carlos Felipe Jiménez Bello have just won the Nobel Peace Prize. They are both calling for self-determination for the Timorese, occupied by Indonesia for the last 21 years. Ramos Horta, who's led the international campaign against Indonesia, has said that he wished that Xanana Gusmão, the jailed rebel leader of East Timor, had won instead. And on the issue of the F-16s, the U.S. government just announced that it is going to push for the sale of those F-16 fighter planes to Indonesia when Congress reconvenes in January. The Clinton administration also says it will attempt to restore IMET military training aid to the Indonesian government, which was cut off after the Indonesian massacre of 1991, in which the Indonesian military killed more than 200 Timorese. One of the smaller massacres in East Timor, more than 200,000 Timorese have been killed since the Indonesian military invaded January 7, 1975. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, Defense Secretary William Perry told reporters that the U.S. Army School of the Americas will never again teach Latin American soldiers to use beatings, torture, and death to try to get information out of dissidents in Latin America. Last month, the Defense Department released sections from the school's training manuals that recommended the use of terror tactics against insurgents. Perry said he's conducting a review of the school's curriculum, but reporters pressed Captain Michael Doubleday of the Pentagon if the review is limited to the 1991 Inspector General's report.
That's the starting point, looking at the 1991 review that was done and to see the actions that were taken as a result of that 91 review.
Will it also examine the underlying purpose of the School of Americas and whether
no,
or not
No, that's not the purpose of it at all.
The Pentagon says human rights are now being taught at the School of the Americas, although Congressmember Joe Kennedy says no one's taking the course. Human rights activists here in the U.S. say the school, which hosted and trained brutal dictators and death squad leaders from across Latin America, should be shut down. In light of these developments, today on Democracy Now!, we bring you a documentary about the School of the Americas called The School of the Assassins by Many, a video produced by Robert Richter and narrated by Susan Sarandon.
Afternoon of December 4th, 1980, an unmarked grave was found in a field in El Salvador. When it was opened in the presence of the U.S. ambassador, it revealed the bodies of four women. Mary Knoll's sisters Maura Clark and Edith Ford, Ursuline's sister Dorothy Kazel, and lay missionary Jean Donovan. Of the five officers later found responsible for the rape and murder of these women, three were graduates of the United States Army School of the Americas. According to the Pentagon, the mission of the school is to train the armed forces of Latin America, promote military professionalism, foster cooperation among multinational military forces, and to expand the trainees' knowledge of United States customs and traditions. The School of the Americas originated in 1946 in Panama. Now it is located on the grounds of Fort Benning, Georgia. The school teaches commando operations, sniper training, how to fire an M16, and psychological warfare. Since no major declared war between Latin American countries has occurred in decades, and the communist threat has vanished, why provide this kind of training? Representative Joseph Kennedy.
If you look at the course ranges that are offered to these individuals, they in fact are a dedicated way of teaching military leaders in foreign nations how to subvert their local communities.
Since it opened, over 55,000 military officials from 23 Latin American and Caribbean countries have trained at the school, about 2,000 students a year. As facts have emerged about the school and its graduates, it has drawn the attention of a growing number of human rights activists, such as Mary Knoll Father Roy Bourgeois.
Just down the road here is this school, the School of the Americas. It's a combat school. Most of the courses revolve around what they call counterinsurgency warfare. Who are the insurgents? We have to ask that question. They are the poor. They are the people in Latin America who call for reform. They are the landless peasants who are hungry. They are healthcare workers, human rights advocates, labor organizers. They become the insurgents. They are seen as el enemigo, the enemy. And they are those who become the targets of those who learn their lessons at the School of the Americas.
What has been learned about the lessons taught at the school? In the 1980s, the civil war in El Salvador became a focal point for human rights activists throughout the world. Death squads operated freely, often killing 50 people a night. There were so many cases that on March 23, 1980, Archbishop Oscar Romero in San Salvador made a plea to the military leaders of his country.
I would like to make an appeal in a special way to the men of the army. In the name of God, in the name of the suffering people whose laments rise to the heaven each day more tumultuous, I beg you, I ask you, I order you, in the name of God, stop the repression.
While celebrating Mass the next day, Archbishop Romero was assassinated. A number of years later, the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C. made an important discovery when they obtained a copy of a declassified cable. Kate Doyle.
These two cables are both from the American Embassy in El Salvador. One is from Dean Hinton, who was then ambassador to El Salvador in 1981. And it discusses a meeting during which Roberto Daubuisson plans the murder of Archbishop Romero. During the meeting, there is described a lottery that the people who are attending the meeting hold to see who would draw the right to kill Romero himself.
Daubuisson was trained at the School of the Americas. Also trained at the school were two of the three officers directly responsible for the assassination. December 11th, 1981, El Mazote, a small village in El Salvador.
Primero llegaron y dijeron que todos salieran a la calle.
First, they forced everyone out of their houses and made us all lie face down in the street, both men and women.
Hombres y mujeres, boca abajo. Y los niños llorando. Los soldados estaban así.
There were soldiers on both sides. Then they moved away to see the women kneeling down on the ground to pray. They killed all of them. Not a single one of them survived. Just me, by the grace of God. I hid under a tree. When I heard the screams of the children, and I knew which ones were mine, they were crying, "Mommy, they're killing us."
Over 900 men, women, and children were massacred. Virtually the entire population of the village and the area surrounding El Mazote. Out of 143 bodies identified in the laboratory, 131 were of children under the age of 12, including three infants under the age of 3 months. 10 of the 12 officers cited as responsible for the El Mazote massacre were graduates of the School of the Americas. They were members of the Atlacatl Battalion, a part of the El Salvador Army. November 16th, 1989. San Salvador. Six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her 15-year-old daughter were slaughtered. To get the facts about this incident, a U.S. congressional investigation began, led by Representative Joseph Moakley.
I went down, talked with the embassy, talked with the military, talked with the unionists. I had clandestine meetings set up with in very dingy places to talk to people that didn't want to talk to me in public. We gathered enough information that we pushed the investigation to the degree that it was concluded and the people were found guilty that perpetrated the crime. The killing was done by the Atlacatl Battalion, which is the crack battalion in that country. And these are the people, some of them had just returned from the United States where they were taught a course on human rights, amongst other things.
19 of the 26 officers implicated in the Jesuit murders were graduates of the school, including Yushi Renee Mendoza, the lieutenant in charge of the squad that killed the Jesuits and the two women. He attended a commando course a year before the massacre took place.
The Truth Commission of the UN substantiated everything that I had brought forward.
The United Nations Truth Commission report, released on March 15th, 1993, cited specific officers for committing atrocities during the El Salvador Civil War. At School of the Americas Watch, just outside Fort Benning, Georgia, Vicki Immerman matched the names cited in the UN report with names in a United States government document.
What I did was I took these officers, all the officers listed in the report, and I took their names and looked them up in this list of graduates of the School of the Americas, which we received through the Freedom of Information Act. What I found were 49 of the 60-some officers listed were graduates of the School of the Americas. These officers attended the school both before and after they committed atrocities. Francisco del Cid, right here, was on the commandant's list a couple years after he ordered the massacre of about 16 civilians and had their corpses burnt.
El Salvador is only part of the school's story. In the entry area of one of its main buildings are photographs of those the school honors, its so-called Hall of Fame. At the top of the list, Hugo Banzer, former dictator of Bolivia, a graduate of the school. Some of the others similarly honored are the former dictators of Honduras, Ecuador, and Argentina, and generals from 8 other Latin and Caribbean nations, many cited by human rights groups for involvement in human rights abuses in their own countries. Among other graduates, Manuel Noriega, former president of Panama, currently in prison in the United States. 4 of the 5 ranking Honduran officers who organized death squads in the 1980s as part of Battalion 316 are graduates. Half of the 250 Colombian officers cited for human rights abuses attended the school. The 3 highest-ranking Peruvian officers convicted in February 1994 of murdering 9 university students and a professor were all graduates. Also, the Peruvian army commander who brought out tanks to obstruct initial investigation of the murders. During the dictatorship of the Somoza family, over 4,000 National Guard troops graduated from the school. Many of them later became known as the Contras, responsible for the deaths of thousands of Nicaraguan peasants in the 1980s. The general in charge of Argentina's so-called dirty war was a school graduate. During that internal conflict in the late 1970s and early 1980s, an estimated 30,000 people were tortured, disappeared, and murdered. General Hector Gramajo of Guatemala was the featured speaker at the school's graduation ceremonies in 1991. Human rights groups claim he is the architect of strategies that legalized military atrocities in Guatemala, resulting in the death of over 200,000 men, women, and children.
As a Catholic priest, as a U.S. citizen, I really feel a responsibility to speak out against that because of this. This does not lead to healing. It leads to death and suffering. In a way, this is a death machine. And this, I want to say, is very close to home because it's in our backyard. It's not out there in El Salvador. This is not in South Africa. We're talking about a school of assassins right here in our backyard being supported and financed through our tax money. It's being done in our name.
$30 million of U.S. taxpayer money was recently spent to renovate school headquarters and these housing units for soldiers attending the school.
It's an outrage. It's the use of our tax dollars, American tax dollars, for what I think your average American feels is a distinctly un-American purpose.
An amendment offered
on September 30th, 1993, the School of the Americas was debated by Congress for the first time in its history. It happened when an amendment to the Defense Department budget was introduced by Congressman Joseph Kennedy.
Mr. Speaker, my amendment would reduce the Army operation and maintenance account by $2.9 million, the amount dedicated to running the Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. The intent of this amendment is to close the school.
Why should we continue to fund and condone military-inspired murder? Why should we continue to train thugs to kill their own people? Vote for peace. Vote for nonviolence. Vote for harmony. Vote for the Kennedy Amendment.
174 voted in favor, 256 against.
We're only 30 or 40 votes short of winning. That means that if people around the country hear about this, and right there, Congressman, we can win. This is an issue that we can win on.
And what's very important right now, I feel, is to let our voices be heard. Bishop Romero said it best. Before he was killed, before he was assassinated by someone who trained at the School of the Americas, he said, we who have a voice, we have to speak for the voiceless. And I realize that we here in this country, we have a voice. We can speak without having to worry about being disappeared or tortured or being picked up. We can speak, and I just hope that we can speak clearly and boldly on this issue.
In April 1990.
School of the Assassins, a video documentary narrated by Susan Sarandon. These footnotes, Father Roy Bourgeois is currently serving a 6-month sentence for another civil disobedience he engaged in outside of the school. And this news, not on the School of the Americas, but on U.S. policy. According to an internal CIA document obtained by Interpress Service and Haiti Progre in New York, one of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency's own agents planned the assassination of senior Haitian government official Justice Minister Guy Mallory. Emmanuel Toto Constant, the former head of the Haitian terror group Front for the Advancement of the Progress of Haiti and a $500 a month CIA asset, joined with senior officers in the regime of Raoul Cedras to kill Guy Mallory. Emmanuel Constant has just been released by the U.S. Justice Department here in the United States. He remains free. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Janet Reno yesterday said she's reviewing a request for an independent counsel to investigate alleged violations of finance laws by the Democratic and Republican presidential campaigns. Common Cause has alleged that President Clinton's primary committee, working through the Democratic National Committee, and Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole's primary committee, working through the Republican National Committee, illegally schemed to circumvent federal campaign finance laws. They call it the worst campaign violations since Watergate. We now go to a news conference held earlier this week by Common Cause, First President Ann McBride.
We believe that an independent counsel must be appointed and should be responsible for conducting only this investigation. We take this serious step because we believe that there are substantial grounds to believe that the Clinton-Gore 96 presidential campaign, working with the Democratic National Committee and the Dole for President campaign, working through the Republican National Committee, have each engaged in an illegal scheme to circumvent federal campaign laws, and that during the 1996 election, each have committed knowing and willful violations of the federal election laws involving tens of millions of dollars. Let me say that we do not take calling for the independent counsel lightly. In fact, we take what we are doing today very, very seriously. This idea first arose in June in a conversation between Fred and me and between a former National Governing Board member, Max Pilevsky of California. That was in June. In the interim, there have been months and months of work involving large numbers of the Common Cause staff here. But we, most importantly, we believe the issues raised here are of fundamental importance to ensuring the integrity of our democracy, of our political system, and of the office of the presidency. Let me tell you what, these are not technical violations of the law. These are not pushing the envelope to take advantage of loopholes in the law. What it is at issue here are massive illegal schemes to violate the presidential primary spending limits and to violate the prohibitions on corporate and union contributions and the restrictions on large individual contributions. What is at issue here are massive schemes to violate the commitment the presidential campaigns made to limit campaign spending in order to receive taxpayer funds. What is involved here are massive schemes that violate the trust of the American people. Look, in looking at these violations, it's important not to forget one central fact. President Clinton and former Senator Dole both sought and received millions of dollars in taxpayer funds. And in exchange for receiving these taxpayer funds, both signed commitments to the Federal Election Commission to comply with the primary spending limit of $37 million. During the 1996 presidential primary campaign, the Clinton Campaign Committee and the Dole Campaign Committee and their agents spent tens of millions of dollars in excess of the overall primary spending limits that they agreed to and that applied to each of these campaigns. The Clinton and Dole campaigns also used millions of dollars in soft money contributions that cannot be used in federal elections to directly support presidential campaigns. The Clinton and Dole campaigns made these expenditures through their respective national parties, using their parties as conduits to run multi-million dollar TV ad campaigns to support their candidates. The television ads that were run through the DNC were not party ads, and they were not issue ads. The ads were Clinton and Dole ads, plain and simple. And as candidate ads, they were subject to the contribution and expenditure limits that apply to presidential campaigns. I want to step back a minute and look at the purpose of the Clinton campaign, according to published reports, and in the letter you will see fully documented with cited sources on these matters. That the purpose of the Clinton campaign, according to published reports, was to allow the Clinton Committee and its agents to conduct a multi-million dollar TV advertising campaign for the president's election from the summer of 1995 to the summer of 1996. The goal was to conduct the campaign without any of the money being counted against the $37 million spending limit applicable to the Clinton Committee during this primary period. The ad campaign that was run during this period cost $34 million, which almost doubles the spending limit. The purpose of the Dole campaign, according to published reports, was to allow the Dole Committee to conduct multi-million dollar TV advertising campaigns to support Senator Dole's candidacy during the period, and this is the period from April 96 through the Republican convention in August of 96, at a time when Dole had already spent nearly all of his $37 million that it could legally spend during the presidential period. The ad campaign in this period cost $14 million through June 96, and that's the period in which we have the relevant Federal Election Commission information. Look, in every real sense, these committees made these expenditures. And these are expenditures under the federal election law. The candidates' committee or its agents prepared, directed, and controlled the ad campaign. They targeted the ads to run in presidential battleground states, and they ran ads that name the candidate and promote his candidacy or name his opponent and criticize them. These ads, if you see them, and we have again copies of the ads in the text of the letter, are simply plain and simple candidate ads. The record shows that the circumstances exist here for both the Clinton ad campaign through the DNC and the Dole campaign through the RNC. Under these circumstances, it doesn't make any difference if the candidate campaign chose to use a political party or any third party as a conduit to run its campaign ads, as both campaigns, in fact, did. Since the TV ad campaigns here are candidate ads and the expenditures involved were therefore expenditures under the Act, candidate expenditures, the question of whether TV ads contained any term of express advocacy, such as vote for or vote against, is absolutely irrelevant. While the Supreme Court held that express advocacy is required for ads by an independent group, and this is very important, no court has ever asserted and no one has ever held that an ad run by a candidate must contain terms of express advocacy. No one would argue, for instance, that the Clinton and Dole campaign committee ads that they're spending have to say vote for Dole or vote for Clinton. And in fact, many of their candidate ads do not contain express advocacy. The record demonstrates that each presidential campaign used its respective political party as a conduit to run its ad campaign, and therefore the ad campaign is a candidate expenditure subject to the spending limits and subject to the contribution limits. But the same result would be true. We believe, and I think the record clearly shows that they used them as conduits, but it would be the same even if each presidential campaign and its national party had engaged in a joint venture in which the candidate committee and the party coordinated their activities with each other. I want to just take a minute before I take questions to just run briefly through a little bit of what we know the Dole campaign did and the Clinton campaign did. Again, in the back of the letter, you will see a long and highly documented recitation of these facts. From the summer of 95 through the summer of 96, the Clinton Committee ran ad campaigns through the DNC to promote President Clinton's reelection. Again, and I think these are the important three points, the ad campaign was prepared, directed, and controlled by the agents of the Clinton Committee. The ads were targeted to run in presidential battleground states by the agents of the Clinton campaign, and the ads promoted President Clinton or criticized his presumptive opponent, Senator Dole. The ad campaign was financed in large part by soft money raised by the agents of the Clinton campaign. The Clinton committee spent on the ad campaign during this period at least $34 million in excess of the spending limits. And in doing so, used at least $22 million of soft money, contributions that cannot be legally used to directly support a presidential candidate. The ads run by the Clinton campaign, again, were in every respect candidate ads and the same kind of ads that any candidate would run. It's very important, and in the documentation, we show that from June 1st, 95 to July 30th, 1996, The Clinton campaign spent $27 million of those dollars in the top 12 states where the most expenditures were made on the ad campaign, including $18 million in soft money. And you'll see in the statement the list of these top 12 states. These states were considered during this primary period as the key states in President Clinton's reelection effort. And this is important. The fact that 8 of those states, California, Colorado, Illinois, Michigan, Missouri, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Washington, were also among the top 12 states where expenditures were made for the ad campaign, for the Dole campaign, confirms that these battleground states were chosen by both campaigns for their importance to winning the election. Any notion that these are issue campaigns go by the wayside when you look at these factors. And this is again important. The amount listed for the top 12 states represent funds paid by the state parties to the two media firms headed by Robert Squire of Squire, Knapp, and Oaks, and its division, the November 5th Group. Based on disclosure reports filed at the FEC, Common Cause has over months traced virtually all of these soft and hard money funds as moving from the DNC to the state parties and then being paid by the state parties to the two media firms. And I want to tell you that Common Cause analysis of this information will be sent to the Attorney General today, and we have our analysis as well as the original Federal Election Commission documents here for you today. Let me just say that the same factors existed in the Dole campaign. The time period was April 96 through August 96. They ran campaigns to promote Senator Dole's election. They were prepared the ads by agents of the Dole campaign, targeted to presidential battleground states, and the ads promoted Senator Dole or criticized his general election opponent. During this period, Senator Dole's campaign spent at least $14 million in excess of the amount legally it was allowed to spend, with at least $9 million of that in soft money. Again, the Dole campaign and its agents designed and produced the ads, determined the placement of the ads, made the media buys, and raised the money for these ads. This included the campaign's chief media strategist, Don Sippel, the chief pollster, Anthony Fabrizio, and Dole's chief fundraiser for some 30 years, Joanne Coe. The Dole campaign, when you look at their 12 states, they spent more than $13 million of their money in these top 12 states, and more than $8 million in soft money, and $4.5 million in hard money. Again, it's important to look at the overlapping 8 states. In addition, 3 of the 4 other states, Georgia, Tennessee, and Iowa, were also considered key states in Senator Dole's campaign. And based on disclosure reports, we have filed at the FEC, Common Cause has again traced the money from the Dole campaign, from the party to the state to the media buys that were made. I just want to point out, and this is in the statement, that Senator Dole's expenditures do not represent all of the money of the Dole campaign, since the party reports are not yet available for July and August 96. I want to just close with a story of one of these ads. What you have is an ad called The Story. And what it is a glowing biography of Senator Dole, in which it talks about his Kansas roots and his war record, and is clearly nothing but a biography. At the end of this ad, according to published reports, the ad concluded with the innocuous entreaty, "Call your elected officials." At the end of this Dole bio ad, they said, "Call your elected officials." What one was supposed to tell them was never made quite clear. They attempt to cast the ad as an issue ad rather than a dull ad, belies reality, and frankly just shows in one little story what's going on here. The ad is the same kind of biography that any candidate would use as part of his or her campaign. The other thing is that Senator Dole made perfectly clear that the ad was intended to support his candidacy. Discussing the ad, Dole said, "It's not Bob Dole for president. Never says that I'm running for president, though I hope that is fairly obvious since I'm the only one in the picture."
That is Anne McBride, president of Common Cause, calling for the Attorney General to investigate campaign finance abuses by both the Democratic and Republican committees. And you've been listening to Democracy Now!, which is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. We thank you for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.